Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome to the podcast. I'm Genuinely Grace and I hope you've had a good week. I hope you enjoyed our podcast last week with Catherine Gregg. Got some great response from that podcast. I mean, she's always amazing value, Catherine. But one of the things that I think really people really identified with was our chat about setting boundaries. And I've been thinking about it quite a lot this week because I've realised how much has changed actually for me since I stopped drinking. You know, when I was drinking, I was such a people pleaser. And as I said on the podcast with Catherine, I would drink because somebody else was. I mean, literally, it's that daft. And a few people on the Sober Club have said the same thing, you know, that this peer pressure that they feel. And even when they've stopped drinking, they feel embarrassed that they're not drinking around other people who are. So it's crazy, really. But it really is all about setting our boundaries. And so much has changed for me. I now know that I can, you know, I can still be kind and calm and a decent person, but not have to, you know, take shit. So so that was a really cool chat. So thank you again, Catherine, if you're listening, and to anyone who enjoyed that podcast. It got to number, I think it was 17 when I last looked in the Apple Mental Health chart, which is just fantastic. I love the fact that this podcast charts in that category, you know, where people are considering their mental health. I wrote an article this week for an online website that talks about menopause. And, you know, as I was writing the article and doing a bit more research, it just came home to me again, just this massive link between alcohol and, you know, anxiety and mood swings and irritability and all of these issues and symptoms that we wrap up as, oh, well, just part of getting older. And, you know, for women, oh, just part of the menopause. And for guys, oh, well, you know, just what it is going through life. But actually, the reality is that once you ditch the booze, I'm not trying to say it's all unicorns and rainbows, but without any shadow of a doubt, you get to at least know what's going on with your mental health. I think that's the issue. I don't think it's necessarily that in every case, everything will become perfect. But you do at least get to see it as it really is. You're not medicating on top of self-medicating, right? You know, if you decide to go the route of medication, it will be because you're starting from a place of being able to really assess what's needed. And I just think that's, it's absolutely massive, isn't it, really? If you're new to the podcast, you know, what we do here is take a completely non-judgmental look at ditching the booze and how we can just live our best lives. I say that because I've had a few new members in the Sober Club and they're just kind of getting the feel of what this is about. One woman said to me, you know, I definitely don't want to stop drinking. You know, I want to be a mindful drinker. I want to drink mindfully. So I'm not going to stop, but I want to be able to control it. And, you know, our take on that is, if that works for you, then, you know, great. I know almost no one that it works for who accept that they don't have an off switch. in other words, as I've said many times before, you know, I consider myself a mindful banana eater, you know, I suppose, if you had to really, you know, if you really asked me, because, I like bananas and occasionally I'll have one. I might go for a week, I might have one every day, and then I might not have a banana for 3 months. It just isn't a thing for me. I certainly wouldn't listen to a podcast or need inspiration from other kind of mindful banana eaters, because it's just not a thing for me. So I do think for some people, of course, that's exactly the way they are with alcohol. Really isn't their issue, really isn't their thing at all. But for those of us who do not have an off switch, for those of us who have that voice in our head, the addictive voice telling us, go on, just have another one, then I don't know that mindful drinking works. But again, the whole concept of what we do is completely non-judgmental. I don't care how you got to this place. It just matters to me that you you feel that you're living your best life, or you're working towards it, that you're being kind to yourself, and that you're giving yourself the best shot, you know, not that awful self-loathing that happens so many times. I see it all the time, and it's exactly how I used to be, exactly how I used to be. So I, you know, I really get it. And, you know, I've definitely been there, done it, got the T-shirt. So yeah, so thank you if you're a new listener. We appreciate it. We really, really appreciate it. And sharing the word about the podcast and sharing it with friends is just so, so appreciated. And if you want to drop me a little message of feedback, I would, I'd love that. I'd love to know which shows you've enjoyed, you know, which guests have really resonated with you. Any little nuggets of wisdom that you've pulled out from any of the podcasts, it would be fantastic to know about those. Let me just tell you what's going on. We have a couple of Sober by the Sea dates. That's our kind of retreat days. It's just a day, but as some people have said, you know, who've been on the last couple, it can be transformative. Just one day where you get a bit of sea air and you focus on what you really want, on visioning what you want. Because sometimes, even, you know, maybe you haven't ditched the booze yet, maybe you're unsure about that, or maybe you've been sober for years, but you haven't yet stepped into that new identity. You're not quite sure what is there for you in the future. Because there's no doubt being sober makes you brave. So you have to, you know, really be clear about what it is you want, and then you can go after it. So anyways, we have a few places, I think, on September the 4th, Saturday, September the 4th. And then we have a new date added of September the 25th. It's in Southend-on-Sea, which is very funky. And I know it's a hell of a long way. It's a long way from anywhere, actually, apart from Southend. But you know, one woman came all the way down from the northeast and gave herself a few days in a local B&B and just had the best time. You know, actual self-care. That's what so many of us haven't done in ages. So September the 4th, September the 25th, and we probably might put another one on as well. We'll have to see. So do please go to thesoberclub.com/events or just drop me a message if you want more information on that. We also have our Champneys retreats. They're 2-day retreats at Champneys in Tring in Hertfordshire. And we have a new date added. So the October one is full, but we have a new date added, which is November the 20th. So if you can make it to Champneys in Tring, again, if you look at events, DM me or give Champneys a call. They'll be able to help you with that. Again, for any of these events that I run, it, you know, it really doesn't matter to me if you are sober curious, if you're day one, if you've been sober 5 years. It's all about the what's next. It's about the optimum health and well-being, the emotional well-being, underpinned by the sobriety piece. So we have that event at Champneys in November and another one in January. I think it's the second weekend in January, if you're planning ahead for a boost for the new year. So we look forward to meeting some of you. For those of you who are not in the South, and I know that's an awful lot of you listeners and Sober Club members, I genuinely do want to do some retreats, some meetups in other parts of the country. It's just, as you'll be well aware, been so difficult with restrictions and not knowing if things are going to change. And so it feels like a big risk to kind of book something up in another area that I don't know well, if we don't know what's happening. But it will happen soon, I promise. For any of you who follow my Platinum Awards work and my Imperfectly Natural stuff, all the entries to the awards are in, and it's super exciting that we have a pop-up shop in September. So put that in your diary. That's at Bloomsbury in London at Hello Love, a little pop-up shop where we showcase some of the Platinum Awards entries. So it's really great to be able to actually go and see and feel these lovely natural and organic products. So I'll tell you a bit more about that nearer the time, but put that in your diary, 13th to the 30th of September. Anyways, today's guest, I'm really thrilled that I got a chance to interview psychologist and positive psychologist, Sarah Gregg. This topic of happiness is something that I've been intrigued by for years. Sarah's book is Choose Happy. And many years ago, long before I quit the booze, I remember reading a book by Robert Holden. Of course, I know Robert well now, you know, as a fellow Hay House author. But Robert wrote a book about happiness many, many years ago. He also used to run laughter therapy, which years ago I used to think, what even is that? But yeah, so I remember reading about the sort of the science of happiness, and awful lot of years ago. We're talking probably 25. I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, something like that, I got into Gretchen Rubin's work. Some of you will know Gretchen Rubin. Does amazing work around choosing happiness. And I remember back then that I did a few of those little kind of courses and read the books and tried hard to kind of to do this thing of choosing happiness. And it just seemed to evade me. It really did. And I remember, you know, if you'd asked me at the time, I would have just said, well, yeah, I get that some people can control, in inverted commas, their thoughts and their reactions and can put in place stuff to choose happiness, but I can't. You know, I genuinely thought, you know, I probably thought this song was about me. It wasn't for me. I just didn't think it was for me. I thought it was not possible for me. It was for everyone else, but not for me. And I now realize, of course, as I've said so many times before, that it was alcohol that was getting in the way. It was the fact that I wasn't authentic. I wasn't fully in. I wasn't fully who I was meant to be, if you see what I mean, because I was just drinking all the goddamn time and pouring wine on it all. And so, of course, I couldn't step into that place of being kind to myself and choosing what was best for me, because every time I tried to do that, there would be this just cognitive dissonance going on. Something just didn't fit because I was numbing everything out with booze. So it feels very different now. And it was just great to be able to talk in depth about this topic. Sarah also did an exclusive Q&A for us in the Sober Club. And, you know, you can go really deep with this topic. It feels like a real bit of woo-woo. But in fact, it was quite funny because on the information that Sarah sent me, there was a little typo. You know, we all do it when we're jotting out stuff on an email. And she gave me a little sentence to read out about her work. And what she'd written there was something like, you know, in the third person, it said her no-nonsense approach can help people to focus on, you know, X and X. But the typo had missed out the non or the no. So it just said her nonsense approach. And I thought, and I sent this out on an e-zine to Sober Club members. That's just so funny how, you know, the word no can make such a difference. So if you are someone thinking, oh, please, you know, this is all woo-woo and very Pollyanna-ish, I hope you'll think differently after our conversation. Enjoy the interview. My guest today is Sarah Gregg, and I'm really pleased that we're going to be talking about happiness, and particularly this lovely, lovely book, Sarah, Choose Happy, Easy Strategies to Find Your Bliss. I absolutely love it. We'll talk about the book, but welcome. I'd love to know a little bit more about you. Tell us a bit about your background.
Yeah, so it's so lovely to be here, first and foremost. So my name is Sarah Gregg. I'm an author and psychologist. I'm a member of the British Psychological Society and have a bit of an obsession with human behaviour and all things happiness for as long as I can remember. But I think like most people who probably join you, you know, as guests or people you interview, it's not always kind of plain sailing. And I think some of the pivotal moments that come in our lives are often from a place of darkness and a place of negative emotions. And certainly kind of that was a major change for me in 2016, when life looked really good on the outside. You know, I had a really nice job. I worked for a university in the UK, had a beautiful house in the Cotswolds. I had ticked all of life's boxes and done everything that I was meant to do and followed the formula for happiness and success. Mm. But on the inside, I just felt empty and unfulfilled. And I began to really question, what is happiness? And is this the right formula? And as a society, have we got it right, you know, through the decisions that we make, through the direction that we're told to travel in? And I felt like I was just running on life's treadmill and didn't know how to get off. So I made a very dramatic decision and almost kind of like just hit that emergency stop button and threw myself off. And I sold my house, quit my job, and left with a backpack in 2017. and never look back. I started my business, The Power to Reinvent. I started to research happiness and flow, more specifically from the psychology point of view. That led to 2 book deals, and I still live out of my backpack and travel the world full time. And I'm currently in Taiwan.
Amazing. I mean, that's quite a kind of a dramatic thing to do, isn't it?
You yes. know,
but many of us probably won't do that.
Yes.
But it's very exciting, you know, to hear your story. But I'm interested that, you know, you mentioned there, you alluded to the path that we're meant to follow, in inverted commas. Mm-hmm. And it is almost this thinking that you know, we get a job we like and we find the house and we have the 2.4 children. Do people even say that stuff anymore? I don't know if they do. But there are certain things that we assume will happen for mm-hmm. us, and that those things outside of us will bring us happiness. You've done all this training as a psychologist and in positive psychology particularly. Mm-hmm. What does science tell us about happiness?
Yeah, great question. So positive psychology was really born out of the psychoanalysts, who were really delving into the negative emotions and analysing what was wrong with us. And positive psychology really takes that look on, well, actually, what makes us happy? How can we play to our strengths? How do we understand, you know, and learn from happy people? But even positive psychology has evolved into what we kind of call positive psychology 2.0. which is really this understanding now that actually we need a blend of both, that we need to look at the synergy between positive and negative emotions, because negative emotions in themselves are actually very useful. They're the clarifying forces that kind of jolt us into action. You know, often when we're in that pit of despair and we don't know how we're going to get out of it, everything else drifts away and life kind of almost forms into a bit of perspective, and you're able to make really meaningful changes and choices. So what science and psychology now really looks at is, how do we sit in the discomfort of our emotions, both happiness and sadness, and how do we be with the feelings that we feel? Because I think ultimately we chase happiness, and it's the one emotion that we want to feel. But equally, when we get there, we're often still looking behind our backs, you know, thinking, when is this going to end? Something bad must be around the corner. This is too good to be true. So it's really just learning how to be with the emotions, to understand that the emotions are just that biofeedback. They're just a way to kind of signal what's going on, and how then you can tap into your own inner compass. You know, what is happiness for you? Because ultimately, that's a subjective question.
Yeah, it's such a good point. And it's something that we talk about a lot within the Sober Club and on, you know, on my podcast, because what happens for so many people when they finally decide to ditch the booze, if they've been drinking for years or come out of any addictive behavior, is they very often realize that, oh, okay, so life doesn't immediately become perfect. That's just the way it is, sadly. You might think that, you know, the minute you stop drinking, all of a sudden you lose a lot of weight and you sleep well and you're bouncing around with energy and everything's marvelous and it's all unicorns and rainbows. And obviously it isn't. However, I mean, we'll talk more in a while about how joy definitely does come in, you know, which is another spin on happiness. But what I was going to say was, what almost everyone discovers sort of quite quickly after ditching the booze is that we do all have these emotions that we certainly interpret as being very unwelcome. And in the past, we haven't had to deal with them because we've just numbed out. You know, so it's something I say quite a lot, is that many of us are quite emotionally immature. Because literally all of the big stuff, all of the important things in our lives, when they've rocked up, you know, we've just reached for a drink. Someone was saying in the group the other day that I think it was someone in their family had a crisis or an illness, and immediately the thinking was, okay, reach for a drink. You know, we somebody has a baby, we reach for a drink. So somebody upsets us, we reach for a drink. So we're not practiced, are we, at knowing how to sit with our emotions? It's such an important thing.
Yeah, not at all. And I think we're taught this connection. What's really interesting from a psychology point of view is how advertising is very much linked to our emotional state, And I don't know if you know this, I'm sure you do, but Freud, the very famous psychoanalyst, it was actually his nephew that made the link. He noticed that in Freud's work, that the collective mind, if you could understand that and link our irrational behavior, you know that actually when I feel good, I reach for some alcohol, which is a depressant, which ultimately in the long run isn't going to make me feel good. Or when I feel bad, I do the same. And Bernays was his nephew. And he looked at it and he thought, well, actually, if I could understand this irrational, emotive, you know, discomfort that we have with our own emotional estate, if I could link that to a product or a service, could I change people's behavior? And he could, and it was actually one of his biggest first projects where he tested it, was linking females to cigarettes. So he kind of associated with freedom torches, he called it, because he linked the fact that women felt very disempowered and that smoking was a symbol of masculinity and power. And so he linked that to that feeling. And that's very much what we do and we see with alcohol. It's an irrational choice. We know that it doesn't make us feel good. We have multiple hangovers.
Yeah.
You know, we feel terrible. And yet we have this collective amnesia because the message and the rhetoric all the time with happiness is you can buy it. It's something outside of you. And here is the proof. You know, here are the people, you know, watching the sunset, having a glass of wine. You know, here is the person deep in their sorrows, you know, reaching for, you know, a whiskey with their friend or whatever it is. And I think we're very, very much taught that happiness lives outside of us. It's something that we have to earn. It's something that we can reach for. It's something that we can purchase. And really, that is as useful as strapping sandwiches all over your body and thinking that it can cure your hunger. It just doesn't work. It all kind of starts from within. And that sounds like cheesy, kind of American, you know, you've got to work on within. But it's true. If you don't know how to be with your emotions and you don't know how to handle them, and you're not really brave enough to step into that uncomfortable space, because I think it is uncomfortable to say, is this choice in alignment with what is actually going to make me happy?
Or so is obviously it not? That's such a good point. And if you're going to do that, you've got to have your own definition of happiness first, haven't you? Because, you know, as we started off saying, you know, for you, you needed to sort of up and leave and get your backpack and go. That definitely wouldn't be my definition of happiness. I can't think of anything more stressful.
Yes.
So it really is what makes us tick. And again, many of us haven't even thought about that since we were kids.
No, I mean, when was the last time? I mean, when I think back, when you're younger, you're maybe asked, what do you like to do? Did you enjoy that? But as we merge into kind of adulthood, we stop even checking in with each other. We don't ask ourselves. I remember one of the pivotal moments for me was, you know, I went to this motivational seminar, just anything to kind of perk me up. And the person leading it said, write down three things that make you happy, three things that you just do just for you, for no other reason. And I remember watching this theater of like hundreds of people, you know, frantically scribbling in their notepads. And I thought, I have no idea. I'm in my mid-30s. I have no idea what actually makes me happy. I've never stopped to think about that. And so I wrote down the three same imaginary hobbies that I had when I was 16, you know, and wrote on my CV, you know, reading, swimming, you know, and walking. And that was all I could think of. And I remember in that moment feeling really uncomfortable, but actually really determined then to discover, what does happiness mean to me? And actually, at the start of the book, Choose Happy, that's one of the first tips is, what does happiness mean to you? You know, how do you understand happiness to be? Because often we're trying to measure how happy we are when we don't know what it means. And that's really as useful as kind of trying to work out how tall you are against someone else when you don't know your own height.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, it's really interesting, this whole piece about, I think that partly this comes down to what your values are and whether you feel sort of authentic with who you really are. You know, listeners to the podcast will know that I talk a lot about the fact that, you know, for many years, I wasn't authentic with who I was meant to be because I was drinking. And obviously, in my unconscious mind knew that.
And so mm-hmm. I couldn't, for example, sit in meditation or you know, I didn't really like to be with myself very much because there was this disconnect. So I suppose it really is, as you say, taking the time out. I know you've got some exercises in the book where you encourage people to just get back in touch with what is important for them, I suppose.
Yeah. And sometimes it's the book really tries to bring it back to the simplicity. You know, we can overthink and overcomplicate a lot, but sometimes it's starting with those small, tiny changes that can actually create happier results and have that ripple effect that really gathers momentum over time. You know, when you start off with, okay, I don't really know what I enjoy doing, and I'm not really sure what my definition of happiness is, and I'm not 100% accurate or clear on what makes me happy. It's just being at peace with where you are now, not holding any judgment, you know, for the past, and then just making those small little choices that in time gather that momentum and guide you and, you know, enable you to flow towards where you're meant to be.
Where does gratitude fit in with this and kindness? Because, you know, I've often said in the past that I think when people feel really down and really depressed, if there's nowhere you can go, in inverted commas, if you can't do anything with that, you know, if you don't have the motivation to go for a walk or get dressed, then start with gratitude, you know, because there's always something to be grateful for, right? And then the next thing you can definitely do is something kind for someone else. Mm-hmm. You know, I know many years ago that got, you know, someone I was very close to out of a bit of a funk. You know, she was in a totally depressed state and genuinely could not think of one single thing that she could do at all. It was quite frightening, really, mm-hmm. when people are like that, everything, it feels very numb. And I suggested that she wrote a list of three things she was grateful for, and then went and bought a newspaper for a neighbor who couldn't get out. It was such a tiny, simple thing. But actually it was massive, you know, because we all know, don't we, that kindness is good for you. So making yourself do something for someone else. So what would you say about both gratitude and being kind to yourself?
I would say that's excellent advice. And it's very much proven, you know, within psychology, we know gratitude, for example. I practice it in the morning because it's almost like a neurochemical super smoothie for your brain. It changes the structure of your brain. It releases a lot of really feel-good hormones. So it'll give you that hit of dopamine, which is, you know, the instant kind of hit of happiness. And it's that reminder that there is good in your world, even if it's in the smallest of things, like your coffee, you know, the person that smiled at you in the supermarket the other day. The ordinary often is the extraordinary. You know, we're always chasing these really, really high highs.
Yeah.
But actually, it's the ordinary moments in our lives that sometimes we can overlook that bring us the most joy, and they're the things that we most miss. And I think that's something we really all, you know, saw and felt and experienced during lockdown. You know, we missed that connection to other people. We missed walking through the supermarket and being able to stop for a chat.
Yeah.
And it also regulates the hypothalamus, which is responsible for sleep and stress. And so that automatically just relaxes your nervous system. So when we wake up in the morning, often the first thing that we typically do is we reach for our phones and we scroll through the news, and, you know, our brain is overloaded with a million different people's thoughts and our nervous system already feels tense. But when we start with gratitude, our nervous system relaxes, we get that hit of happiness. And it's proven, like you said, that people who practice gratitude are kinder to others. And I think that's a really important part of choosing happiness, is it not only impacts you as an individual, but it has this beautiful impact on the collective, because people who are happier within themselves are able to help those who are not, or they have a wider sense of perspective rather than that arrow of consciousness always pointing in inwards. You know, when you're consumed with those negative thoughts, like you said, it clouds your vision. You know, you miss the small moments, you miss the joke or the compliment or, you know, the important opportunity. So when we cultivate happiness, we're able to see the world a lot more clearly.
Absolutely. I mean, you've got this, it's such a lovely book. For starters, it's like a beautiful gift book. I love the graphics. Yeah. I love the way it's laid out. I love the fact that it's very dip-in-able and there's lots of lovely little tips. It's really nicely done. But, you know, we can't go through it all, obviously, but, you know, you cover looking at boundaries and, you know, thinking, looking at your thoughts, of course, and taming the inner voice. A lot of the stuff I talk about a lot. You talk about fun in the book, which I love, taking back control, moving forward for the future, self-compassion. I'm interested in your section on letting go of the past, because again, this is something that, you know, when I work with clients, sometimes they'll tell me about the benefits that they're really finding, you know, amazing benefits from stopping drinking and it really feels as though life is beginning, but there's unresolved stuff from the past, whether it's anger or trauma or grief or sadness, and because, as we've already said, you can't numb it out anymore. You can't, you know, when those thoughts come out up, you can't just, you know, have a bottle of wine. You have to face it one way or another. Mm-hmm. So how do we choose happiness when we have, you know, baggage, a ton of baggage from the past?
Yeah. First of all, it's not easy. And I think it takes a tremendous amount of strength and courage even to admit that you have that baggage, that there's this internal chaos. You know, you've been sweeping problems under the rug and, you know, there's been inner conflict. And then when you take that step back and you're not numbing it and you've got to face that discomfort, first of all, it's really difficult and it's a very unique journey. So, it's not easy, and we often make choices within constraints. However, our mind is a time traveling machine. And although the past, present, and future is very linear in terms of time, you know, we can be in the past at a flick of a thought. You know, we can be right there, right back in that moment, you know, feeling the emotions as if they were happening right now. And part of letting go is really about telling a story of redemption or giving it meaning. That's probably the biggest thing that psychologists have found, is that it's not that it doesn't matter what happened in the past, because it does matter, but what matters more is what you do with it and the story that you allow that to tell. And so, for example, and this is kind of a great one for this group, there was a study done by psychologists where they looked at members of AA. And they find that people who's told a story of redemption, in other words, they looked at the bad things that had happened in their past, in their life, and they told a story of what good came from that, what they could take from that, how it was somehow in this chaotic universe meant to be. Mm. And they find that when stories had that element of redemption, people were more likely to remain sober, in fact, by up to 4 months more sober than others. So I think it's not necessarily about letting go. It's not about forgiveness, even, for example. You know, it's not about saying it's okay that that's happened. It's not about that. It's not about glossing over everything. It's about, okay, it has happened. What do you do with it now? What is a better way to look at this? What meaning has come from it? How has it somehow led you to this point and to this place that you're meant to be in? And how will you use it for good in the world? Because life is difficult. And I think that's the conversation that isn't really sexy and it doesn't really sell. You know, when you say life is hard, but it is hard, and it's hard for all of us as human beings. And choosing happiness is really about the acceptance that it's not necessarily always going to be easier, but there is always a choice to make something good out of something bad.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, while we're on the kind of the heavy stuff a little bit, what about our people that surround us, you know, family, friends, partners, and their impact on our happiness. I have a question actually that was sent in, and so someone asks, could you ask Sarah for any ways of focusing on happiness if a partner is extremely depressed and contemplating self-harm? So, you know, if you're with someone else, how do you then choose happiness?
First of all, it's very difficult to watch someone that you love feel those emotions and to contemplate some form of self-harm. And it's very easy to take responsibility, you know, for that emotional state. So I think the first bit of advice is make sure that your cup is full first. You know, you have a finite amount of energy. It's almost like we walk about with these buckets of water. And if your bucket is drained, it's very, very hard to give anything. You'll find yourself more frustrated. Yourself, you know, your own health will deteriorate, and there will be two people that need to be seen. Yeah. So first and foremost, look after yourself. Second of all, just allow that person to be where they are. See them as the whole person. Know that this is their journey. Know that this is their responsibility, and that this is something that they have to figure out themselves, and that you can be with them, you know, holding their hand, guiding them through the process and letting them figure it out. But ultimately, we cannot save anyone else. And we've just got to focus on those small little pockets of joy, you know, the little moments that come in, and offer ourselves that place of compassion, and also not be afraid to ask for help, you know, to reach out to other people to make sure that your support system is strong. When you're supporting someone who is in a very, very dark place, you carry that a lot with you. And sometimes the bravest thing you can say is to ask for help and to be vulnerable. And to say to others, you know, in your close circle, I need you right now, and I'm going to need you to listen. And I'm, you know, I don't need your advice. I just need you to hear where I am and be seen and heard and gain energy and strength from that.
And I suppose that leads us on to the fact that, you know, we do all need connection with people that can somehow hold the vision for us. You know, I think, again, another thing that I find a lot with clients or with people that I come across is they become very used to retreating. And I don't mean that in the good sense of the word. You know, they isolate themselves when things start to get tough. And rather than, as you say, reaching out for help and being willing to be vulnerable, but be with like-minded people who may well have some support to offer, or at the very least, just a kind word, that people tend to retreat away. Am I right about that? Is that something that happens, and what's going on there, and how can we encourage people to see that that's not going to be beneficial?
I think it's very natural to do that. You know, the body and the mind is always trying to protect itself, and every behavior has a positive intention. So the withdrawal, the isolation, it's almost like putting a shell of protection around yourself. And I think that's partly because of our culture, you know, because we're told, you know, not directly, but inadvertently, that sadness is almost associated with failure, that the universe, you know, you've done something wrong and you're being punished, and, you know, you haven't got life right, and that you're down on your luck, and that people feel sorry for you and, you know, pitiful. And I don't think any of us ever want to be treated in that way. And so it's easier just to try and cope with it by yourself rather than to open up, especially when we are disconnected from our emotions. You know, sometimes it's hard to even find the words to explain how you feel, and it's draining and tiring to do that. So it's much easier just to be with it by yourself in a locked, dark room. Vulnerability is so important, and it's going to be messy, and it's not about getting it right or saying it in the right way to anyone. It's just about letting that energy literally leave your body, you know, let it come out in whatever way it does. It could be anger, it could be tears, you know, it could be a mumbled kind of like mass of words, but as long as it comes out, that's the main thing. But it needs to come out to the right people. Vulnerability is not necessarily to be shared with everyone that you meet. You need to find those trusted people who can hold that space, who will let you just be in that moment. And I think what the great thing is about the world that we live in now is that if you don't have that in your immediate family circle or friends, there's great online communities, you know, that you can turn to. If you feel more comfortable talking to a stranger, it comes back to that point we made at the start. It's about what feels right for you. You know, who does it feel right to share it with, rather than a hard and fast list of you need to go to three people and they need to be this, this, and this. It's wherever you feel safe to share that. And that takes the shame out of it, because I think shame is really the main reason that we don't share, because we feel embarrassed.
Yeah, absolutely right. I often talk about the fact that when I first stopped drinking, I didn't actually tell anyone because I felt such a sense of shame. It's actually look back now and I think it's just bizarre because I didn't feel the shame when I was drinking, but I really felt it when I'd stopped. I really felt such shame because for the first time I was having to actually face everything. And you know, you're right. Shame is one of the kind of lowest vibrations, isn't it? You know, it's really, really tough to feel good when you've got shame going down. Tell us maybe just, I mean, I love the fact that in the book, as I say, you give us lots of little exercises. One of the ones is five ways we can savor the present. I don't know if you've got it in front of you or if you can just remember, but do you want to just give us a couple of those maybe?
I can't remember, but I do have it in front of
me. Yeah, yeah. So
I would love to say I had it memorized.
Gratitude, we've already spoken about, really. So, and we were saying, you know, look around you and notice, you've said here, notice obvious things to be grateful for, and then think about other, you know, obscure fortunes, as you say. Now you talk about nature here. Now, and of course, this is just such a game changer, isn't it? And I think if not before, over lockdown, many people found, okay, do you know something? I can't control anything that is going on. I have no idea what the hell is going on here or how I'm even feeling. But if I can just go and walk and sit with my back against a tree, I feel a little bit better. You know, I can breathe at least.
Yeah, exactly. And I think This is all based on research. And what I love about the research that comes out about happiness so often is it's the really, really simple things that, you know, you don't need a lot of money to access, that, you know, you can just get out and have, you know, a walk in the park and instantly you kind of feel better and you feel that connection, you know, gratitude, a pen and a paper, like that's all that you need. Yeah. And, you know, a few minutes of your day to kind of get going. Exercise, the small act of kindness.
One, isn't it? Yeah. Exercise, just on that, just for a moment. You know, I think, again, many of us sort of literally forget to move. And sometimes, and I've found myself saying this to clients before, when they're in extreme anxiety, it can be a really great idea to literally get out of your head, but I mean that in a good way, and get out of your head and just get into your body and just go for a run or a walk or just dance, because it really changes the brain chemistry, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does. You know, we operate a lot of the time with the front of our brains, which is the prefrontal cortex, like the thinking brain, and that's where the ego lives. You know, that little voice that's always chattering in your head, you know, filling the narrative. But often when we exercise, we enter the state of flow. And in flow, the ego dissolves and the prefrontal cortex goes down. And it's almost like a form of mindfulness. So we literally, we just are turning the volume down on our brains. And I think on top of that, things like yoga and kind of small movements, they're really good at getting you back into feeling what your body's trying to tell you. You know, often when we live too much in the mind, we miss those little small cues of discomfort. You know, I know for me, for example, I stopped drinking over lockdown. I went for 9 months and now I do like a lot more mindful drinking. And what's really interesting is I can really sense in my body the moments whenever I want that glass of wine. And it's normally from really tiny bits of discomfort, you know, just like a little bit, oh, that didn't go too well, or, oh, that's making me feel a bit uneasy, or I've had a conversation about that person and now I'm like really itching for it. And so I think when we do things like yoga, walking, it just gets us more in tune with the body. And point number five, which is in the book, which I love, is like, do anything but not everything, because I think we have to be really compassionate towards ourselves. You know, we can feel like we want to take over the world, and we can wear busy as this badge of honor and be like, okay, 5 a.m. in the morning and I'm going to do, you know, 20 different things, and I'm going to get up, and then the evening, and we overwhelm ourselves. And we know from psychology that, you know, willpower is a finite resource. Like, we can use it up. It's not an infinite amount. So we've got to be really gentle to ourselves and just focus on building those small habits, you know, let them kind of build up that momentum, build that foundation, and then move and grow from that place.
Yeah. Yeah. Love it. Well, there's so much more we could talk about, but it's great. It's great stuff. I mean, just one last question, I suppose, would be, you know, can we all choose to be happy?
Yes.
That's a simple answer.
And I think the world would be a really sad place if we thought that we couldn't. Mm. And that doesn't mean that it's easy. And it takes that practice of a pause. You know, choice is really that space in between. It's that moment when you decide which direction you're going to go. And there's no right or wrong choice. You know, ultimately, there is always choice. And we can make those happier choices. And it's okay if sometimes we don't. And sometimes, you know, we end up in a corner and we need other people's help and we're kind of like rocking, and other times we will make the right choice, but choice is always there and it's always available to us. And I think that's a beautiful gift that we have. Mm.
Sarah, thank you so much. I love the book. It's really pretty. It's actually, you know, it feels nice just to hold it.
It's lovely.
Choose Happy, Easy Strategies to Find Your Bliss. And do you want to give us your website if anyone wants to find out any more about your work?
You can find me over at thepowertoreinvent.com, or if you want to check out the book specifically, it has its own website, which is choosehappythebook.com.
thank you.
So I'll make sure I put the link to the show notes in Sarah's book in the show notes, and make sure you check out more of her work. We'll definitely get her back as well, because there's a lot of levels to this. It fits really nicely with all the stuff I like to do around self-care and just getting back in touch with, you know, who you really are. We talked about connection. Sarah talked about the importance of being connected with people who really get it, who really understand, who are there to support you. And obviously, I'd love to encourage you to join the Sober Club if you haven't already checked it out. It isn't big, it is small, and it's very supportive and completely non-judgmental. And I'd love it if you would take a look. It's thesoberclub.com. It's a full membership portal with a whole bunch of stuff in there, videos and interviews and just a whole massive load of informative stuff and inspirational stuff and motivational stuff, and an exclusive Facebook group where we have many conversations and we have meetups online, and there's just a lot going on, and it's very supportive of whatever stage you're at, because it's about the everything. It's about the optimum well-being, the emotional well-being, underpinned by that sobriety piece. So I look forward to seeing you next week for the podcast. Don't forget, you can share this, rate it, review it, drop me a message. You know where to find me on social media, and I absolutely love connecting with you, and I love giving you a big up if you are doing this hard thing. So let me know. It's a really great idea to tell someone if you're doing this. So feel free to tell me, and I will absolutely be your champion. See you next time. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.